This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Terra Nova Earth Talks. We speak with cutting-edge experts and wise elders from across the globe on the issues and action our Earth is calling for. Brought to you by the Terra Nova Foundation, driving environmental change through human connection and collective action.
Welcome to Terra Nova Earth Talks. Today we take a close look at the relationship between the economy and the environment. We explore what our current mindset is, the challenges ahead, and we consider what an economy could look tomorrow, the near future, and in 20 years. In the last 15 years, there's been a wave of new ideas and possibilities for how an economy can run. Many still embrace capitalism or market forces in earnest, with some tweaking around the edges. Others consider major overhauls and complete resets, while others have really taken command to new levels. What is for sure is that our current economies are on the out. But what do we mean by the economy? An economy is everything to do with the production, distribution, and consumption of resources. It is the complex net of everything to do with goods and services and how we trade. Economies are notoriously complex as they are driven by and involve people. The way we look at our planet, our cultural norms, our historical legacies, our laws and regulations, and where our economies are geographically all influence what they look like and how they operate. An economy might refer to a nation, multinations, or even global economies, but it can also refer to local, regional areas or towns and cities. As a species, we have taken our survival and turned it into a swirling tornado of unwritten economic ideals and rules that flings out those that can't keep pace or don't fit the mold. It relies on rhetoric and loyalty to the mantra and can knuckle down on threats. However, the economy, no matter which one is being referenced, is not a living being. It is a reflection of human beings, how we act as individuals and together as a business or community or a government. Few economies are embracing the very foundations of its success, the earth, with extractive practices still fueling most of the world's consumption. This means, as human beings, we are actively participating in economic behaviour that is and will kill our wonderful host. So, what can be done? Because economies can be small to global, it can seem a beast beyond our possibility. But if we stay with it being a reflection, a mirror image, we can start to see how an economy can be transformed into one that puts our earth first. Our founding grounds, our source of well-being, our survival. The question is, how do you shift to a different kind of economy? How do you shift human behaviour so that we as a species fundamentally start to produce, distribute, consume in a way that isn't, frankly, stupid? There are examples around the world of economies that do just that. We have reference points all around the world. So how can we shift? How can we go from economy versus the environment to economies that put Earth first? Well, today we have a renowned expert with us who can weigh in on some of these big economic issues. He is based in Aotearoa, New Zealand, and will be a familiar name to many of you as an economic straight-talking thought leader, calling it how it is on a wide gamut of issues. He is a regular and respected contributor to media, government and business sectors discussions on economic and strategic matters. And he is an author of multiple top-selling books, including Growing Apart, Regional Prosperity in New Zealand, The New Zealand Economy, An Introduction, and Generation Rent. We welcome today to Earth Talks, Shamabile Jacob.
Hello, Rose.
Hi, how's it going, Shamabile? It's so wonderful to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm going to get straight into it, because we've got a big topic. There are many questions that could be asked here. But the first one I want to ask is, what do you think are some of the key economic drivers, no matter where we are in the world? How's that for a reasonable question to kick off this discussion?
It's a very big question. And I think the first is really around the context of what do we mean by the economy? Like you started, Rose, I think the idea of economy has become quite corrupted by what we measure rather than by what we mean.
Mm.
And the economy is really about how we interact with each other. That's what the study of economics is. It's a social science. It's about how we interact with each other. It's not actually about inputs. It's not actually about outputs. It's actually the quality of life and making more people better off while doing the least amount of harm to others.
Mm.
So in many ways, the philosophical foundations are quite different from how we might think about things. But there's also this kind of challenge about these narratives of when we talk about economic models, economic activity, what do we mean? Are we talking about inputs? Are we talking about the resources, the people, the pollution? Or are we talking about the incomes of people and the incomes of businesses and the incomes of the returns to nature? Or are we talking about what we're spending our money on if we're investing or saving or consuming? What are we actually talking about? And the reality is it's all of those things. And that's what makes it very difficult for us to have this conversation about the economy, because it's a very nebulous concept in some ways, but also the word is used to mean different things by different people. And we tend to bump into each other by not having that common definition or that common lens.
So do you think a lot of the conversations then almost start off on a bad foot, if you like, because there's so many assumptions before the discussion even begins?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the frustration that I have is economists as a general rule, and not true of everybody, are not good communicators. They're not good storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's the stories and the narratives that knit together our ability to have these conversations. Having really clear definitions for what we mean, what they entail, is really important. So as an economist, for me, I might think about the economy in quite proximate ways, right? So, for example, I'd say, here is the economy of New Zealand, and I could decompose that into the people, the workers, the capital and the resources that we employ, and the kind of the technology and the innovation that we employ. But those are not the drivers of growth. That's how I might describe the economy and the growth of an economy.
Right.
The drivers of growth might be the geography of the place, the quality of the institutions, the culture of the nation, what luck we had historically. How do you even have the conversation when we're actually talking about two different layers of descriptions of what causes economic growth?
Right. And this is an issue across all environmental issues too. What is the root cause of the thing that we're talking about? Because as soon as you skip to the surface, you're starting to deal with that really superficial interactions and solutions and all those kinds of things.
Absolutely. And I think in some ways, because of the way that we measure the economy, sometimes these things also get sidetracked. So, you know, when GDP, you know, that measure of the economy was first introduced, it came with a very big warning. It's not for everything. It's to measure up the things that we're doing. It's not to be the be all and end all, but just one tool in your toolkit. But what has happened in some ways is we've reduced many things down to this one indicator and say, this is what creates good growth. Or that if you're in opposition, well, it's terrible if the GDP is growing, that everything must be terrible. It means we're using more resources. Now, neither of those statements are true.
Mm.
It can be that rising economy and a growing economy might be a good thing, but it doesn't necessarily say anything about the distribution of the growth. It doesn't necessarily say whether we're being more climate intensive or emissions intensive in the way that we're growing. So, for example, in New Zealand, over the course of the last 20 years, we've seen the relationship between emissions and economic activity really diverge. Our emissions have gone largely sideways. Our economy has continued to grow. Now, it's not true then that everything about economic growth is bad, that it's all about creating emissions. But it's also not true that it's giving all the outcomes that we want, like better distribution, making more people better off. Because we know that in New Zealand in the last 40 years, our income inequality hasn't changed at all.
Yeah, right. So you keep mentioning the word growth, which is now coming into play quite a lot. One of the things that I've found is that growth itself is, there's a lot of assumptions made. So growth can be a qualitative thing. It doesn't need to be purely about the amount of money made. So that's, I'm guessing that comes into play too. When people are talking about the success as being growth, they often are only talking about money as opposed to other aspects of growth that are really critical.
That's true. I think when we talk about growth, you know, what is it all for? Mm. It's for making more people better off, right? And so when you kind of start off with the big question of what is it for? What are we trying to do with economic activity and economic growth? And what does that growth entail? So that growth could be because we're just throwing more resources at it. Mm. We're using more people or more capital or more natural resources, whatever it might be. Or it could be that we're just getting a hell of a lot better at what we do. Mm. Yeah. And so we might not be using any more of anything, but we're getting better at it. Or it could be that with the amount of stuff that we have, we are just making people much happier.
Mm.
All of those things might be true, but it doesn't necessarily follow that they're all related.
Right.
And being able to substantiate and differentiate between what we mean by growth and the quality of that growth and the distribution of that growth is really important.
Mm.
And I think quite often the fights that we have with each other is this, again, this nomenclature, right? This language that we use. I don't think we're talking about the same things.
Mm.
And we make these big assumptions that when Shamabil says growth, he means that we're going to be using more petrol or more fossil fuels.
Yeah.
Well, maybe. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it must be a bit of a minefield, I'm guessing, for you when you're commentating on economics, actually, now that I'm reflecting.
It is and it isn't. I think again, it goes back to the fundamental idea of what is it that we're trying to do. You know, if you can define the outcome that we do all of this economic activity for, which is about making more people better off, I think it becomes a lot easier.
Mm.
And that more people better off doesn't mean that we ignore the natural world or we ignore social things, because the reality is that people are not better off if we're killing the planet, right?
No.
And when I talk about more people better off, that includes future generations.
Yeah.
You know, time is not a constant. Time is not a given.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So that nicely is a nice segue into the next question, which I've got to you, actually, and this is where we look at, so often the economy is described up against the environment, you know. So I've said economy versus the environment. And up until now, we seemingly have got away with ignore the environment bit, but that's changing significantly and at a very fast pace. Can you talk us through some of the changes that are really causing shifts, the good and the bad?
Yeah, a great question. And let me start by saying that the idea of natural capital and the planet and the environment has never been separate from the idea of the economy. It's thus just that we prioritized all the other things over the planet and over the environment. So it's not like we didn't know that economics was silent on these issues. It's just that as society and as politicians, we decided not to pursue it.
Mm.
And so the way I think about it is, for a very long time, we borrowed from the future.
Mm.
We chose to massively pollute our waters, massively use fossil fuels, massively pollute the air.
Mm.
We chose to do these things by bringing forward future growth, borrowing from the future and borrowing from the planet's future. That was the idea, right? That it was worth it.
Mm.
It was worth it to lift millions of and billions of people from poverty, because that was what the calculus that we made. And the way that we did it is we kind of said, yes, it's true that there are these costs or externalities, as economists say, but they're not worth more than some of these other benefits that we can create by lifting people out of poverty or creating jobs or creating better lives or making it easier for us to be able to commute or watch a movie or whatever.
Mm.
And that was the trade-off that we made. But I think we are changing, and we can see that in terms of the recognition and the urgent recognition that something needs to change in terms of climate change, in terms of emissions, in terms of waste reduction, and all of those other bits and pieces. And that's come about because it's almost too late.
Yeah. we hope it's not entirely too late, but we're definitely down the path a long, long way.
Yeah, and I think as we experience the consequences of those past, I think, unbridled pollutions and externalities, we can now see, one, the hopelessness of that strategy of borrowing from future generations. But two, it almost feels insurmountable. No, I don't think it's insurmountable. I think it's entirely possible. But it's about how do we work together, because there is a sense of urgency to be able to do that differently. Now, like I said, you know, in my head is this picture of, in New Zealand, for example, we have managed to decouple emissions from economic growth. And, you know, this annoys some people a lot because they go, it's not possible. So we must shrink the economy. We must degrow, whatever that means, right? And so those are all well-meaning things. It's not that those are wrong. It's just that I think the ideas are based not on the evidence, but on this fear that if we don't do something, it's not going to change fast enough. And I agree. We do need to do things faster. And the way we do, we make change, we might change by tinkering with existing things. We might introduce new ideas, or we can entirely change the objectives of what we want to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's the latter that's required, right? We need to actually change the objectives and go, it's not enough. It's not okay to say that we are going to trade future generations' ability to live on this planet with our comfort. There is a fundamentally selfish perspective. And at the moment, it's that set of values that has gotten us to where we are. But I'm starting to see the shift. I am starting to see the shift because we are seeing policies around climate change. We are starting to see policies around reduction of fossil fuel. We are seeing innovation that reduces the emissions intensity of economies. So these are good things. But to me, the big concern is really around not that we're not making progress. The big concern for me is it's not progress that's fast enough.
Yeah, and this is where the shift in behavior is required, right? When we can kind of nudge things along and do some good, but we've got such a significant challenge ahead. One of the things that I personally get quite frustrated with, and I'm not sure you can tell me if it's just a personal thing or not, maybe, but the reference to natural capital. And so to me, there's a shift required to sort of put our arrogant hat down as a human being and not look as the earth as simply a bank for us, but actually the supporting host. I mean, I use the word host quite pointedly, really, because it is the fundamental source for us as a living being. So if we continue to look at it in terms of what we can take or taking less or whatever, to me that feels like part of the issue in terms of when we're talking about economic success, if you like. Is that, what do you think?
Well, it's a really interesting conversation, and it's one that I've had in many different forums. And the reason for that is what is the role of humanity? Are we the apex group of living beings who get to decide everything? And is it our right first and then responsibilities? Or is it our privilege to live on this planet? The language really matters. And I would reflect on, I guess, the way that ecological frameworks work or indigenous economic frameworks work. So in New Zealand, of course, we have the New Zealand Māori, and their kind of tikanga frameworks are quite similar to how most indigenous economies kind of think about the economy. And they're in contrast to the orthodox way of how we might describe it as orthodox economists. So as an economist, I might describe the economy as, you know, the economic returns to ownership of assets, right? And it's protected by those property rights and some responsibilities, but rights first. And the benefit is for me. For the individual. When you take a tikanga or an indigenous framework, it starts with an idea that it's about economic outcomes, not economic returns, economic outcomes, through the use and stewardship of resources, which are not fungible. So we can't say that we're going to pollute the river, and because we made some people richer, those two things offset each other. These are not fungible. And they're not fungible because this economic outcome is enabled by the responsibilities that we have and the privileges that we have. But it's responsibilities first and then a privilege. There is no right And the way that Indigenous populations do it and Indigenous cultures do it is by having that spiritual connection with natural resources. The earth, the sky, the air, these are part of you and part of your spiritual frameworks. And so, you know, when you defile the river, you are defiling your God or your spiritual ancestors. And that's an extraordinary burden to put on people. And so the reason I'm telling you this is because I think partly it's about how can we think about our role on the planet and our interactions with the economy? What do we actually mean by that? What does a successful economy look like? And does it start with us being the apex living beings who have rights to extract and use it to the advantage of ours only? Or do we have a privilege? You know, do we start from a position of privilege and we have responsibilities? And I think that's what's really changed. I feel like that's the fundamental value gap that we have at the moment, is we still think that somehow this was created for us rather than this is what created us.
Right. And that, yeah, that's such a wonderful clarity. Love that. It's also, you know, we don't really need much more evidence to suggest that the command approach, our right, doesn't really work very well. We're on not a great trajectory when we're operating in this way. So I don't think we need any more studies to tell us that that option is not really going to help us going forward. So I guess, you know, like many things, if we can detach from that way of working sooner rather than later, that would be good, because then that can free up the possibilities, you know. But as long as we're sticking to that kind of idea that we have a right to exist here and we have a right to ownership of land and all of these things, we're going to be very problematic.
It is, but it's also the weight of history, right? The way we do things is the way we do things. And shifting from the weight of history, that inertia is just so powerful that it is hard for us to change, even when we see the problems. So I don't think it's easy, but I think we recognize that there is a problem. And the way that I think about it is, I think our individual senses, there is a sense of discomfort. There's something about the present that's not correct. We can tell, right? We can all share in this sense of dread and urgency that something has to change. But we don't know what the future holds. The future feels uncertain. It feels uncharted. I don't think that's true. The future is not uncertain to a great degree. We actually know the kinds of things we need to do.
Yeah.
Tools and policies are pretty well described.
Yeah. I have to agree. It's amazing how many people say this to me and I'm like, so what are we going to do about it? Or actually, you know, and they move on. I think the action we can take is there, definitely. I think the frameworks are there. Just let's dive in, because a topic that comes up a lot. And so sometimes I hear these incredible conversations about the, you know, new ways of looking at the economy and all that sort of thing. But then it's almost like at the end of the year, everyone just drops into talking about GDP again. Like everything beforehand, you know, didn't matter, because actually we just have to stick to GDP. Now, gross domestic product is what I'm talking about. And the clues are probably in the name, but what do you see as the risks to GDP going forward as we see the dramatic environmental change? Is GDP as a measure fit for our current and future Earth, do you think?
Look, I'm a geek and an economist who's doing this for a long time, so I'm quite attached to GDP. And I'm quite attached to GDP because it explains and helps us understand some things. But it's like anything in life, it's a tapestry, and it's only one thing that helps you give you one lens to think about how the economy is working. And so there are absolutely known and planned gaps in GDP, right? So, for example, we absolutely do not count environmental costs. So all those emissions, all the environmental damage is not counted in GDP. So it doesn't mean that GDP is useless. It just means that we know this, and that means we should count it as well.
Right.
We know that when it comes to natural disasters, for example, we don't count the damage, but we count the repairs.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't use GDP. It just means that we should also count the damage, and we should make better efforts to understand where the damage is, what the consequences are, and what follows.
Yeah.
We know that we don't talk about distribution when it comes to GDP. Mm. If the aggregate is the sum total, fine, because that's what it's intended for. Mm. It doesn't mean I don't care about distribution. It just means that we need to put more effort and more focus on that as well. So the way I would say it is that for those who use GDP as a single measure of economic success, you're stupid. Right? Because if you look at the writing by the person who put this together, Simon Kuznets, even he said it's not meant to do everything. It's not meant to do the heavy lifting on everything that we wish for as humanity. It's one measure and one proxy for one thing.
And he was quite clear right from the beginning, right? And then like 20 years later, he said the same thing again, like, stop using it. Like, it is the be all end all, essentially.
It is. And I think, you know, we got census of that in New Zealand when the earthquake happened in Christchurch. So, you know, in 10 odd years ago, when we had the big earthquakes in Christchurch, you know, huge devastation, loss of life, GDP hardly blipped. And then we had this extraordinary economic growth because we built a new city.
Mm.
Well, what about all those people whose lives and livelihoods were lost?
Mm.
Well, all that capital that was lost, did that not matter?
Mm.
Of course it matters. It doesn't matter in GDP, but it matters for society. It matters for humanity. It matters for the people who are involved. So I don't think it's true that we don't recognize that it's not the be-all and end-all. It's just that it's easy because it's a proxy.
Mm.
But again, it goes back to the beginning of a conversation. What are we doing this for?
Mm.
What is all of this for? Why do we do the things that we do? Why do we get up in the morning?
Mm.
Well, we want to make ourselves better, but we also want to make our community and future generations better. We want to take care of the planet so there is a legacy.
Mm.
These are all the kinds of ideas that I think are at the core of people, but not necessarily externalized, not necessarily identified.
Mm.
And again, you know, just to kind of riff on the indigenous bit, the reason why I like the indigenous knowledge system is because they're very specific and explicit about what does success and good look like, which includes the planet, which includes community and society. It includes individuals, but it's within that context of the whole.
Mm.
Within which there is a community and within which there is an individual.
Mm.
The triangle is upside down to how you and I would more often than not have a conversation.
Mm.
It's the individual that sums up to this community and that happens to be within the context of nature.
Mm.
And the hierarchy is all wrong in my head.
Yeah, and that it's kind of a fundamental for measurement, right? You can have all the best measures in the world, but if you don't actually know why you're measuring, then those measures are useless, right? So you need to know what impact you're trying to make. Then your indicators will make sense. But without that impact, you cannot.
Absolutely. I mean, again, so that's why, you know, I understand the criticisms of GDP. They're not new, but for me, it's a really useful tool, but that's all it is. Like anything, it's a tool. You know, when you want to understand something as complex as the tapestry of the whole of humanity, of course you have to take multiple lenses and multiple tools, and you still won't understand everything. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. And so I think when people make these criticisms of GDP, yes, we understand. I understand.
Mm.
But it is only a tool. And if you take a step back and go, actually, maybe we're not starting at the right place of asking, what is it all for? Then you kind of fall into the trap of using the wrong measures for the wrong things.
Brings a thought to mind of the happiness index and the well-being. And New Zealand's definitely been put up there as being very progressive in this area because we started putting indicators that in place that would give us a little bit more than just purely GDP, where we looked at other things. Can you give us some insight into some of the thinking around perhaps that or similar type frameworks?
Yeah, really good question, Rose. I think for me, that expansion of the indicators of success into well-being, into happiness, it's really trying to get to the sense of why are we doing this?
Mm.
What is it all for?
Mm.
And it is for the betterment of humanity, but within the context of what's happening in our wider planet and our wider ecosystem. And that's why the well-being measures are so important and happiness measures are so important, because happiness is not just about how much money do you have. It's also about friendships. It's also about connections. It's the connections with nature, whether or not it takes you 4 hours to commute, whatever, right? Mm. Everything, it feeds into everything. So these measures, I think, they are helping us to elevate the conversation a little bit. But the problem is their measurement is so complex, so data heavy, that quite often they're not frequent, they're not high quality, they're not comparable. Yeah. And so we fall back on GDP as the proxy because of those weaknesses in those other measures. And also the challenges, I think, the movements in terms of the ideas around well-being in New Zealand, at least, I applaud that. But what we called well-being budgets in New Zealand in recent years did not have much well-being in them. And I get frustrated that sometimes, like GDP, well-being gets captured by the political forces for their own benefit rather than truly delivering on what well-being might mean.
Yeah.
So there is this lack of translation between what we mean by well-being, what well-being levels are today, and what would lead to that better or improvement trend in well-being for all of the community.
So I guess it comes back to almost your rhetoric's not good enough. You can't just simply say things and put words down. You actually have to really be committed to what the difference that you want to make, what you want to see as the world. You can't simply just wish it well and hope that the implementation will happen, because it won't.
That's true, but I get a sense of optimism from the fact that we are measuring something.
Yeah, true.
And it's to make change, you need light and heat. And at the moment, we are starting to shed some light on what drives well-being. That it is what we always know. It is more than GDP. It is more than a job. It is more than the wage at your job. It's something bigger. But what is it? That light is slowly being shed on that. But there is no heat in the system to change from how we do things today. So that new knowledge, that recognition that what success looks like is different from what we might have assumed, means that we have to do things differently, but we're not quite there yet. So I think we're in the transition path, but let me relay my earlier frustrations. It's all taking too long.
Now, look, I'm going to move on to some of, because I know you've got a wealth of knowledge, so I really want to tap into this. And I'm sure you have a catalogue of economies and economic practice examples that span a whole range of countries and eras. Could you give us some insight into economies that are different or exciting prospects from your point of view?
Look, it's really hard to point to a single country economy and say that is the perfect model.
Right.
And the reason I say that is because there's so much context. You know, the context of what happens in New Zealand is not the same as the context of what happens, say, in Sweden or the UK or in the USA. And so the things that excite me the most are more about, like, the indigenous knowledge frameworks, because that allows you to make decisions that are far, you know, looking far into the future rather than starting from today. I like the progressive policies that we're seeing in the supranational agencies, for example. You know, we know that we need a global price for carbon, right? And the intellectuals agree, the academics agree, the scientists agree, but the politics gets in the way. So the examples of those bright ideas of the solutions that are out there are in hotspots, not necessarily all encapsulated in one economy or one country. Because more often than not, you know, people are running their old economy and adding new things in.
Right.
And some of those new things might be very good. Yeah. It might be around the, you know, massive uptake of public transport. We know we have to do that to reduce our emissions. Or there are countries that are massively increasing their uptake of EVs to move away fossil fuels. It's not perfect, but it's helping them reduce their ongoing carbon emissions. There are countries that are electrifying their networks. There are countries that are doing much more on environmental protection. So there are really good examples, but it's really hard to go, that country is perfect.
Will there ever be such a thing as long as humans are on the planet? I don't think, but perfect's not going to happen, is it?
Perfect is not what we're looking for. I think for me, it's around how do we make progress? And for me, the progress comes from three fundamental things. It's about stopping bad things happening, doing more good things, and finding unity and consensus. And, you know, identifying what we must stop and what we must do more of is somehow fairly easy, right? If you think about all the IPCC reports or all the big body of literature on decarbonization adaptation, we kind of know what those things we should stop and what those things that we should do. What we're weak on is how do we find that unity and consensus to be able to create the political will and force that's sustained over time to be able to put those things into place.
And that presumably is going to take those who are benefiting the most or very well on the existing way that things operate to make the shift along with everybody else. Just thinking, you know, this is where politics gets difficult, right? Because those that have power and influence utilize it to have more power and influence. But we really need a human intervention. I feel like there needs to be a reconnection as human beings to what's actually important and real. Like to back to your point, you know, what is this all about? And if it's simply to feed our ego and our monetary purses, then we're not going to do very well. There's no good part to that. So we somehow need to shift, and people need to shift and be comfortable with less. Maybe would that be?
Maybe. And I think it's about giving people choices, and it's about our appetites and desires. And unfortunately, humans, as you know, we are wired for more. We crave more, more sugar, more food, more stuff, more satisfying, right? And the reality is that none of it makes you happy. More stuff doesn't make you happier, actually. But our bodies are wired to kind of give you that almost biological feedback that we feel better when that happens. And I think fundamentally that's what gets in the way. So if I think about the politics of it, individually, when we're having a conversation rationally between the two of us, we will agree that we should do these things. But will we still think that when we go to the shop and buy that extra thing that we didn't really need? Will we make that extra trip in our car when we probably could have avoided it? And there is this kind of disconnect between how we might express our values versus that kind of almost the contradiction in the way that we live. And our political system does exactly that. You know, there's a huge amount of political influence that comes from the losers of tomorrow. The governments and the politicians might not be able to pick the winners of tomorrow, but unfortunately we're being directed by the losers of tomorrow because they have so much to lose.
Yeah.
And it is, I think that's where the politics becomes really hard, our own internal contradictions and the contradictions of, not the contradictions, and the influence of those who are very large at the moment, who are benefiting from the current model of doing things, of not paying attention and due attention to the environment and to the planet and to society. They are the ones who are extremely influential, and that inertia, all of these things together just keep us stuck.
And it's a false benefit, isn't it, really? Because I've referenced a lot Manfred Max Neef. He's a Chilean he was an economist into a socio-economist, and he came up with a framework with a couple of colleagues that set out the fundamental needs of any human in the world at any time. And that was because he understood, or he definitely shifted himself from understanding what you've been talking about to the fact that every human has these needs. And if they're not met, then we start, or depending how they're met, they can be met negatively, which tends to be how we now meet them. So if we're tired, instead of sleeping, we have a cup of coffee, right? It happens almost every aspect of our life. We keep negatively addressing our needs. But if we could shift and address those needs positively, which is where the Indigenous frameworks come in, if you like, I don't want to call them frameworks, but approaches, then because those references then start to talk about our needs and how to address them in a positive way for the long term. So I do think that often in our own brain, we're not framing our needs in the most appropriate way. We're framing them in a very superficial way, as opposed to what is in reality our core and what's in our hearts, if you like.
I think so. And I'll reflect back on that work that I did with Tuhoe in the indigenous knowledge that I learned about in New Zealand. And it was very much around starting from the spiritual all the way down to the individual. And so you take steps through the land and the air and the water, and you have the community, and then you have the individuals. It's nested, but that individual is nested within all of this encompassing thing. And it's your privilege to be in there. And it's your role to be a steward of all those resources and your community to be able to make future generations better off. And the other thing that comes through, I think, is not just in indigenous thought, but also if you look at our history, in the way that past generations built infrastructure for people 100 years in the future, we've kind of stopped doing that. We make infrastructure and decisions that cost, that bear the cost and benefits to ourselves today, rather than actually creating a legacy for future generations. And I like indigenous ways of thinking, because they go, if I were standing 100 years out or 500 years out, what would that, as a good ancestor, what decisions should I make today?
Yeah, no, it's, if we can even get a drop of that coming in, if you like, across all populations, not just small populations, that would be incredible, I think.
Now, it is. I think individually it's really hard to shift things, right? And it's so hard to shift things individually because we respond to crisis. And like you say, we're all on the proverbial cups of coffee just trying to get by.
Yeah.
So that's why we need not just individual action, we need collective action. And that's why the role of government and academia and all of these things we're doing is so important. We need to change the social conversation and the public conversation to going, yes, we do want to stop doing the bad thing. We do want to do those good things. And yes, we will stand behind this steadfast over time.
Yeah, nice. Well, this is, that leads well into my next question, which is about Aotearoa New Zealand. And it can often be seen as microcosm for bigger global practices. Can you see this country advance a different kind of economy, a different version? Do you think it's possible?
Absolutely, it's possible. New Zealand has an extraordinary capability for change. I'm not confident it's going to happen before other places, but I think it has capability. And that's for two reasons. We're very small in terms of population, but we're also very large in terms of our geography, our landmass, and what can happen in our country. And so if you think about our agriculture sector, for example, we're going to see big changes in agriculture, which is a big emitter, particularly of methane. And it's going to change not just because of what we do here, because of policy, but because of what our customers want. And so we are going to see New Zealand shift really rapidly. If world values change, New Zealand farms and New Zealand economy will shift, and it will shift fast, because our farmers are, by and large, very well educated. We have a science sector that is capable of providing the solutions, and we have a distribution mechanism of knowledge that's actually really good. So absolutely, I'm really excited that New Zealand has the capability, but we will either be done to or we will do ourselves. And at the moment, I feel like we're waiting for our customers and other people to tell us what to do rather than leading.
Yeah, so that's the trick. We either wait till the global community tells us, come on, hurry up, catch up, or we actually decide to lead. And we have, I mean, I've seen it just in my lifetime, the number of times New Zealand's seen as a test pot for many things. There's no reason why it cannot be again. And in fact, we know in this, in Otatahi, Christchurch, we've got an awful lot going on, and all the ingredients are there. It's starting to the recipe that's forming is pretty exciting, actually. We're looking at a pretty good cake. it is definitely possible. And I think that's one of the areas of the economy. Sometimes it can look so big if you're looking outward. But actually, like everything, it starts local, regional, national. There's much that can be done in small pockets that then starts to ripple and ripple strongly.
Absolutely. Rose, the way I think about it is it happens both bottom up and top down.
Yeah.
And it's that unity, it's that consensus. Somehow we need to, one, not only be paralyzed, we shouldn't be paralyzed by the challenges that are in front of us. Everybody knows what the challenges are. We shouldn't be paralyzed because we know what the solutions are. So all we are trying to do now is get agreement amongst ourselves that we are going to agree to stop doing those bad things and do the good things. That's really the missing ingredient now. And that's why those initiatives at local, community, industry, government levels are so important, because we've got to drive it up and we've got to drive it down. That's where the meeting will happen. It won't happen perfectly straight first time around. It's going to be an iterative process. We'll learn from each other and over time. So I feel like, yes, absolutely, we're heading in the right direction because these ideas are percolating. Yes, because they are superstars who are making those big calls, making those sacrifices to try and do the right things. But we can't rely on superstars for everything.
No,
at some point in time, it has to be bigger.
Yeah. And that, so one of the things I just want to touch on there is, so in this region, Canterbury, Waitaha region, Terra Nova is looking at doing that. So we have setting the impact that we want to see for the region and getting these incredible experts and leaders across the region to come together to work out what the catalysts for change are. And that's very exciting. But the one thing that we didn't do was say government's going to lead on this. Let's wait for the government to do something, right? So I think that maybe that's one of the things that often people interchange is economy and government. But in reality, I just think it's definitely a melting pot of everybody across industries, across sectors. Would you see that as well?
It is. I think it's the Overton window, right? Things go from unacceptable to policy as time goes, and it's how quickly you go from one to the other, right? You know, you think about policies like net zero in New Zealand, and you know, it was unthinkable 30 years ago, but what? And so these things can happen. And for me, it's really about going, how do we find the ideas that actually rationally make sense? And I think what you're trying to do, Rose, is not just apply the emotion and heuristics to solve these big problems, because these wicked problems can't be solved with what we already know. You actually have to be rational. You have to open your mind. You have to learn. You have to think critically and laterally.
Yeah.
Only then can you go, what are the right steps for me and my community?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that requires brain power. It requires effort. It requires commitment. But once you've made that effort, your heuristics and your state of mind changes. That's
sure.
What we're trying to create.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That wonderfully said. Thank you. Now, we've got one final question, and this we ask of everybody that comes on the podcast. So we want to always end with the person that's listening, what action they can take, so individual action. And we always want to gain insight from the incredible guests that we have on this podcast. So going full circle to economies being a reflection of us as human beings, what action would you consider people could take to help our Earth and therefore us to thrive?
I think each of us have influence, and it's about understanding where your circle of influence is, whether it's in your family, whether it's in your community, whether it's in your organization, whether it's in your policymaking circuit, whether it's through protest or through doing work, whatever it might be. If you can identify where your point of influence is, that's where you should put some energy into. And for each of us, it'll be a little bit different, but it's about taking that value set, going, as human beings, as humanity, we live within this wider ecosystem. It's our privilege and our responsibility to look after it for future generations. We haven't done a very good job so far, but we can start now. And what we want to see is, within that circle of influence that you have, what are those bad things that you see that should stop? What are those good things that we should do more of? And how do we have open conversations so we can shift hearts and minds? And it doesn't matter at what level it is, how many people it is, every mind that is changed, every mind that is converted to thinking about the world in the right way of the pyramid, with the Earth first, community second, the individual last, only then will we be able to make the shift that we need.
That is fantastic and a wonderful way to finish off our podcast today. Thank you, Shama Beale, so much for your time and for being here and sharing your wisdom on this topic. It's been a big topic, but you've just managed to distill the crux of it so beautifully. So we really thank you for being on the podcast today and here with us. Thanks so much, Shama Beale.
Thank you, Rose.
That's it for us for today. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Terra Nova Earth Talks. For more information on the content and links from this podcast, go to the Terra Nova website. That's terranova.foundation. To listen to other interviews in this series, go to the Plains FM website. That's plainsfm.org.nz. Search for Terra Nova Earth Talks. Also on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Bye for now.